supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. The city of Philadelphia recently invited citizens to offer their opinions on what should happen to the controversial statue of former mayor and police commissioner Frank Rizzo. Black Lives Matter and others have called for moving the statue from its place in front of the Municipal Services Building. Now, the public comments are in, and WHYY's Dave Davies reports they were plentiful and colorful.
The city got more than 3,000 responses. It wasn't a scientific poll, but about 60% were supportive of Rizzo and in favor of leaving the statue where it is. 40% went the other way, and feelings were strong on both sides. Here's a sampling of the comments.
Sell it to the highest bidding white supremacist group and use the proceeds for public parks.
Leave it. He didn't own slaves. He wasn't a tiki torch carrying Nazi.
Line it up with the Rocky statue so it looks like they're both high-fiving, then relocate both to the bottom of the Schuylkill.
Leave it where it is. Don't submit to knee-jerk liberal bedwetting. Sheesh.
Leave his shoes and take down the rest. That's what they did to the Stalin monument in Budapest.
Tear it down. Plant a tree.
Suggestions for a new location included a museum, the Police Union Hall, Marconi Plaza, or other locations in South Philadelphia where Rizzo grew up. What happens next? A team of what the city calls diverse representatives from several city departments and Mayor Jim Kenney's office will review the comments and consider the issue. They'll decide sometime next month whether to initiate the process for removing a piece of public art. That would involve hearings and a decision by Philadelphia's Art Commission. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
There will not be an 18th term in office for Pennsylvania State Representative John Taylor. Philadelphia's longest-serving Republican elected official announced his decision not to run for re-election earlier this month. Taylor has represented his district, which includes areas of the Lower Northeast, Kensington, Fishtown, and Port Richmond, for nearly 34 years. It's been a majority Democratic district his whole time in office. And John Taylor spoke with NewsWorks Tonight host Dave Heller.
John Taylor, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Glad to be with you.
Why are you moving on?
You know, there's multiple reasons, but I think the most critical one is that I worked at a certain level that you needed to work at to be a Republican from Philadelphia. I think I and my staff took a lot of pride in being very, very good at what we did. And to work at that level, that's a major commitment in time and effort. And after 34 years, which will be 34 years, you know, it's time to give my family a little more time. It's time to, you know, on Monday morning, not think about what I have to do all day Saturday and all day Sunday. It's getting home once in a while at 6 o'clock at night and not going door to door. I think I can make a contribution in other ways that don't require being elected in this environment. So I'm looking forward to doing that.
Is Philadelphia politics still door to door and very retail?
Well, I think it is. At the state rep level, people in Harrisburg don't understand this. If I walked out into my district and started bragging about being the chairman of the transportation committee, they would put me in short pants in a hurry and say, I don't care about that. But what about the pothole over there? What about the drug house down the street? What about the abandoned car? So over time, we really became part of the quality of life solutions. Editorial boards and things don't give much credit to constituent service, but we found that we're good at getting that right person on the line to get whether it was a city problem, a state problem, or a federal problem solved for them, even if it didn't have anything to do with government. So I always say if the carpet layer put the carpets in wrong, they would call us. And they said, what would you do? I said, we'll get on the phone with the carpet guy.
As the sole Republican in Philadelphia, was there a cumulative frustration for you in terms of what the folks in Harrisburg and particularly the Republicans in Harrisburg didn't get about Philadelphia and its needs?
Yeah, it was, you know, in some ways, Dave, it was quite the opposite because I became like the person that they talked to about Philly, which is quite a big obligation. But, you know, that's sort of very stimulating as well. I think leadership, at least this Majority Leader Reid and Speaker Terzai, you know, would make sure that I was involved in anything dealing with Philadelphia. You know, I've worked with the mayors, particularly this current mayor and Jim Kenney and even Michael Nutter. And, you know, we work close with the Democrat delegation as well. You know, we're quite a voting block together when we stay together. And, you know, I think you must have to make up your mind whether you're going to be someone that just opposes the majority party at all costs, or whether you try to get some done with them, or you pick and choose your issues.
I suspect in their heart of hearts, most Democrats in Philadelphia would readily say that it's healthier to have a competitive political system, that there's been such a dearth of that now. How do you see Republicans and or independents making progress in the city?
I think that even, you know, my colleagues will be, the Democrat colleagues will be under a lot of pressure from the far left, as we are at times, at least, you know, from social media, from the far right. But it lends itself to good debate.
It lends itself to good debate, but can this fractionalizing also lead to nothing gets done? And certainly
that's
what the public feels about Washington. And,
yeah, no doubt. I think, you know, what I was referring to is Philly itself. But, yeah, I mean, we have it in Harrisburg, and we certainly have it in Washington. And I think it's really a function of people swearing their allegiance to a philosophy, and that if any vote or solution doesn't fit into that philosophy, as much as it would solve the problem, then it's a non-starter. And, you know, you just shake your head with that. And I mean, John Purcell used to say to me, he was kidding, but he would say, I'm a man of principle. And my first principle is flexibility. And he would laugh. But, I mean, I think there has to be some truth to that, where you have to vary from, you know, some core principles sometimes to get things done.
Representative Taylor, thanks so much for your service. Best of luck to you from this point on.
Thanks, Dave. Glad to be with you.
That's State Representative John Taylor, Philadelphia's longest-serving Republican, speaking with NewsWorks Tonight host Dave Heller. The historic flooding in Houston after Hurricane Harvey swept through has revived a debate in Washington over the nation's flood insurance program. WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo has more.
Even before Hurricanes Harvey and Irma, the nation's flood insurance program was mired with around $24 billion of debt. That's why the Republican chair of the committee, charged with overseeing and rewriting the flood insurance program, wants to overhaul it. Texas Republican Jeb Hensarling wants to wind the program down because he says taxpayers foot the bill for people in flood zones.
And so, again, we know for a fact that the program is in debt. We know for a fact that the program is running an actual annual deficit. And so it begs the question, should there be a permanent taxpayer subsidy? I say no. It cannot be. Not when I'm sitting here looking at a national debt clock that continues to run out of control before us.
The flood program got saddled with all that debt in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy. Now tens of billions of dollars are expected to be needed to restore Houston, sparking more talk of overhauling flood insurance. But South Jersey Republican Congressman Tom MacArthur hasn't liked some of the talk he's heard.
But I'm hearing a lot of people say in the wake of Harvey that the flood program is somehow to blame for people continuing to build in flood-prone areas. That is a total misnomer.
MacArthur says the federal flood program is essential because it mandates building standards in flood-prone areas, while also forcing people to pay premiums up front instead of merely getting FEMA grants to rebuild after floods hit. Still, he concedes the program needs reform. MacArthur says people should bear in mind that 80% of homeowners in the flood program already pay premiums according to what damage they're expected to face in the future if the worst happens.
It's about 20% that are either in grandfathered rates, where the maps changed later, or they're in what's called pre-firm. They're in areas where they were built before the flood maps. It's that 20% where rates may have to rise a little bit more over time to make the program work.
MacArthur says there are some good aspects of the current proposal to change how the flood program works, like spending money on prevention and protection efforts.
I think there has to be more investment up front, and this was a proposal that I made that's in the bill. We need to spend more money on mitigation efforts up front. So if we can help homeowners finance lifting their home before an event, we just avoided many fold of that in future losses.
The federal flood insurance program needs to be reauthorized by the end of the month, and MacArthur says they may have to delay efforts to reform it for now.
What I'm hearing is that there may be an extension of the current program. I'm okay with that, but we do need to actually get a permanent reauthorization.
Republican Congressman Frank Lobiondo, also from South Jersey, opposes the current flood insurance bill.
And the bill that's been presented to us, while they've made some improvements, it falls short. And I won't go back after what happened in Sandy and what may happen with Irma and some of these other ones and say this is the best we can do.
Lobiondo opposes provisions in the new effort that would limit payouts to more expensive residences and also changes to a program to make flood insurance affordable for low-income residents.
So our coalition of home builders and realtors and mortgage bankers who are on the ground and know how this works, they've signed off on what we want to do. And they're crucial because they provide, the real-world perspective on what we need to do. So they're on board with the provisions that we want to put in there. They're really not on board with what the formal bill looks like now.
As for the wreckage in Houston, Lobiondo says it's causing him to have some flashbacks to Sandy and is making him firmer in his position.
Yes, I mean, it's all coming back very vividly.
After Sandy, New Jersey made a significant push to buy out properties that get flooded out frequently. Environmentalists say buyouts should be integrated into the flood insurance program to encourage people to move if they get flooded over and over. Lawmakers don't seem to be discussing that as they debate reauthorizing the flood insurance program. For WHYY News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Despite, or maybe in response to, President Trump's continuing criticism of the media, public confidence in the industry has rebounded relative to this time last year. That's the focus of this week's conversation between Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll, and NewsWorks Tonight host Dave Heller.
Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, is it true Americans are less inclined to shoot the messenger?
It is. We had a big drop in that measure last year, which was election year. We asked this every September in our annual governance poll. Only 32% of Americans last year said they had confidence in the mass media, such as newspapers, TV, and radio. That's how we phrased it, when it comes to reporting the news fairly and accurately. And right now, we're back up to 41%. So that's a 9-point gain from last year to this year. Still not great. You've got less than a majority of Americans who have confidence in the media to report the news fairly and accurately, but clearly up from where it was last year.
Clearly, Donald Trump is not the only force driving the denigration of the regard for news, though he has stayed pretty constant in that regard. What are the variables accounting for this relative rise?
We think, looking at the data, that it has to do with Democrats, maybe a pushback or a rebellion of sorts, because when we look at the numbers last year compared to this year, it is Democrats which have jumped up almost 20 points in terms of their confidence in the media. Democrats have always been more positive than Republicans, particularly in more recent years. But this year compared to last year, Democrats really jumped up. Compared to last year, Republicans, who have very little confidence in the media, down there in the teens, didn't change at all. Just 14% of Republicans are confident in the media. So Democrats are driving the change.
Frank, one thing that has seemingly stayed constant going back to the presidential campaign, the regard the public has for President Trump's leadership profile.
That's right. We have some dimensions at Gallup that we have developed over many, many, many interviews with leaders and CEOs across the business world over the years. And last year, and I think we talked about it, we applied these to the presidential candidates, that how well do 12 of these leadership characteristics apply to, at that point, the four leading candidates, including Donald Trump, of course. So we thought it would be interesting to repeat that just about Trump. So we re-asked him, and sure enough, not much has changed at all. Trump actually gets a lot of credit for several leadership dimensions, and these aren't shocking: competitive, intense, emphasizes success, enthusiastic. These are characteristics that even Democrats are willing to say certainly characterize Donald Trump. Now, where he doesn't get much credit at all is at the bottom of the list: being prepared, being consistent, being analytical, being inspiring, and being focused. That's where he scores the lowest. That's very similar to where he was as a candidate. So one thing we learned out of this, Dave, is that he has not pivoted, as it were, in terms of his activities as a leader since he entered the White House, because the public tends to view his strengths and weaknesses almost exactly the same now as they did when he was a candidate last April.
It's an interesting juxtaposition because he does seem to pivot in terms of where he stands on various issues, yet his leadership profile stays relatively constant.
That's right. And we find that when we do some statistical analysis, by the way, that the traits on which he is the highest, that is being competitive and intense and so forth, are not ones that are highly predictive of somebody liking his performance as president. In fact, we've asked workers, rate your CEO on these traits, and we find the same thing, that if a CEO is viewed as competitive and intense and so forth, that doesn't predict well to whether the worker thinks the CEO is doing a good job. It is more things like being visionary and inspiring and caring about individuals that really seem to make a difference, and those aren't the ones that Trump scores highest on.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Gallup poll editor-in-chief Frank Newport speaking with NewsWorks Tonight host Dave Heller. Of the approximately 900 people who died of an overdose in Philadelphia last year, one-third had been through jail. That greater risk for overdose has prompted Philly to launch a new prevention effort, arming those leaving the county jail with the overdose-reversing drug naloxone. WHYY's Alana Gordon reports.
In any given year, 31,000 people go through Philly's jail system. Bruce Herdman, chief of medical operations there, says about three-quarters have some sort of substance use disorder. So beginning next month, the jail will start showing overdose rescue training videos throughout all of its units and visitor centers. And for those with a history of IV drug use, they'll receive a free kit of naloxone, or Narcan, on the way out.
You know, in a way, it's sad that 30-some thousand people that we see here have just a tremendous illness burden. They're about three times as sick as you would expect for their average age. But it is an opportunity at the same time to make a big public health intervention. So doing this, we have an opportunity to help a lot of people through the distribution of Narcan through the prison.
This is a really groundbreaking and innovative intervention to bring to the jail population here.
Megan Reed is a researcher at Drexel who's involved in the effort. She says giving people leaving jail Narcan is a big deal. Their risk of dying from a drug overdose is more than 100 times greater than the general population.
This is mostly due to a loss of tolerance that people might have when they're incarcerated, when they get out, if they use again. It might be a different source or a different supply, but also it's that lack of tolerance, so they're more likely to die of an overdose death.
Reed says prisons and jails in a handful of states, Rhode Island, California, New Mexico, Maryland, have similar Narcan initiatives. The main hurdle is money to keep it going. Herdman, with Philly's jail system, says the effort here gained traction as part of recent recommendations from the mayor's opioid task force. It's funded through the health department at a cost of about $150,000. It'll last at least a year and supply the jail system with at least 2,300 kits. Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
The waterways at the southern tip of New Jersey are being visited by birds that are hardly ever seen in this part of the country. And now people from around the region are flocking to South Jersey to catch a glimpse of a particularly rare bird. WHYY's Peter Crimmins has more.
Linda Matula is from New Jersey. She retired to Bucks County, Pennsylvania, but every year she comes back for 2 weeks during the migration seasons.
I'm here a week in May, a week in September. And when I come down, my job is to bird my brains out. It's migration.
Matula is standing in the middle of a marsh in the Heislerville Wildlife Management Area of Cumberland County. She's here for one thing, to see the roseate spoonbill.
Where are you?
The roseate spoonbill's natural habitat is Florida. It really has no business being in New Jersey. But there it is, on the edge of a field of marsh reeds, hanging out with some egrets and a great blue heron. At about 3 feet high and pink, it stands out.
Yeah, it's pale. It's not pink because we think it might be a young bird. But it's pink enough. Oh my
God. That is Mary Watkins of Bridgeton. And while I was talking to her, two more birders came by. Remember, we're standing on a path cutting through a marsh. It's not like this spot is on a map. But for 2 weeks, this has been a mecca for birders. Many think the spoonbill is here because the recent hurricane activity around Florida and Texas took it off its normal migration course. But Watkins doesn't think so.
You know, they were here before hurricane season, so we can't absolutely say that that's what brought them here. But it might be what's keeping them here. They might not want to go back down until things settle.
The roseate spoonbill is not the only stranger in town. A few wood storks, normally seen in Texas, Georgia, and South Carolina, have been flying around Cape May. These are wading birds, and they may have come this far north because it's unusually warm or they're looking for food. Andrew Dreeland, an interpreter at the Cape May Bird Observatory, chalks up the bird behavior to being an impetuous teenager.
You know, they're the 1% of the population that decides to be adventurous and to prospect for new territories and to let the wind carry them up. And most of the time, in a long-term sense, it doesn't work.
It may be nearly 80 degrees in South Jersey this weekend, but to birders, it feels like Christmas. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. The news director is Eugene Son. Our assistant news director is Katie Colinari. John Musoni is assistant vice president for news operations. And our engineers this week were Diana Martinez, Charlie Kyer, and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks so much for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan for NewsWorks Tonight.